And welcome back. We are still here in studio with K-State Research and Extension's David Scruntz and Jacob Weber. We are very happy to have you here with us on this Wednesday morning. You can listen back to that first segment podcast style on the main screen of our website at the kggfradio.com. Underneath the community tab, you can find and listen back to any of these morning interviews. So again, Jacob and David, thanks so much for joining us here on this Wednesday. You had mentioned it a little bit back at about 7:45 there, Jacob, but the Master Gardener courses are coming up.
Master Gardener classes. We're doing this. We do it every other year in the Wildcat District. We switch with the Southwind District as far as a training site. This year's training was going to be in Parsons at the Southeast Area Extension Office. Great facility with all the electronic facilities there, connectivity with the K-State. If necessary, and a good projection equipment. And some of the classes are going to be, of course, pre-recorded videos that we're going to be watching, but most of it will be in person, live, with a teacher, instructors from K-State and from the local. James Coover will be teaching soils and fertilizer, and I'll be teaching basic botany and a little bit of plant science. And of course, we got other classes. We have entomology Dr. Raymond Cloyd from K-State. Plant pathology, Dr. Judy O'Mara. Actually, she's not a doctor, she's a master's. She's Judy O'Mara, but a plant diagnostician, and she does an excellent job. Cheryl Boyer does woody plants. Dr. Charlie Barden will do tree maintenance. Who else we got on board? Kind of right off the top of my head. I can't think of them. Okay. Well, anyway, it's a very comprehensive class. The classes are going to be on Fridays from 9 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. We have a break for lunch. We also have a break in the morning and a break in the afternoon. We have goodies and things, refreshments, which is always a nice part, a little bit of 15-minute break and time to talk and visit with all the other folks that take the classes. This is a volunteer training program, very comprehensive education in horticulture, but it does require that participants go through the 4-H volunteer screening process, because the potential for each volunteer to be working with children is necessary requirement, so that folks need to be aware of it. It's going to require that. So if any folks are interested within the Wildcat District, which includes Wilson, Montgomery, LeBette, and Crawford counties, other counties are welcome to go through the training as well, provided that there is a Master Gardener program within those counties and it's supervised by the local agents. That local agent, of course, would make arrangements. But this is open to anyone who has a high school diploma or equivalent GED. It's not open to high school students. It's only open to those who have graduated. No other requirements other than make a commitment to return 40 hours of volunteer time for approved projects, either working with the K-State educational program or the Extension educational program or approved community service program within the district. So folks interested in the Master Gardener classes, just contact the local office, either in Wilson, in the Fredonia office, the Independence office, the Altamont office, or Girard office, and let us know. We'll send you an application form, information about the classes. And that does require also a commitment to follow the Master Gardener Code of Ethics, which that's outlined in the program as well. So give me a call. We're looking at filling the classes. We need at least 15 participants to do the program, to do the classes, to justify the expense of getting the instructors from Manhattan to come down. So we need folks to call us.
Well, great. It sounds like you had mentioned, you know, a handful of different names. Will those kind of be mixed in intermittently per week, or will they kind of all be there week in, week out?
The classes are on Fridays. We have six Fridays that we're going to be doing classes, a morning and afternoon. Each session, a morning session or the afternoon session, is a class taught by an instructor. We get about 2.5 hours of instruction time. There's no charge for the instruction. It's a free instruction. That's why we require 40 hours of volunteer time. But there is a registration fee of $80. $30 covers the cost of the training manual. It's a $30 book. Then there's a $25 specialist travel and technology fee that K-State charges, and there's also going to be a $25 fee to pay for the meeting supplies, which we do a pretty good job of providing some good refreshments at the meeting, so you don't have to go worry about starving at the training, so that we have a good time. Hopefully we do a good job. People have gone through the classes, really have enjoyed it. So give us a call.
That's kind of what I was going to ask is, what is your normal audience there at that? I know you do them every other year, but is it kind of the ones just starting out, like you had mentioned, just out of high school trying to get some new tips, or do you see a wide range of folks?
Most of the folks that are going to sign up for volunteer training are those who have recently retired and have all sorts of time on their hands and want to get involved with some, maybe learn a little bit more about horticulture. Really have a strong interest in that. That's mainly the target audience here. But that could be changing, because in the future the delivery of the Master Gardener classes will be changing to more of a podcast type training on demand. And then maybe some meetings to discuss, like a recitation where we cover some of the topics and go over some of the other issues that people need, or that applicants need to complete the coursework.
Well, again, great. It's a good opportunity, very comprehensive, as Jacob had mentioned. It's going to be, you know, a pretty busy Friday, and then what you had mentioned, six Fridays is what it is?
Yep, six Fridays, but they're not consecutive. Okay. It begins September 20th, and we do need to get everybody registered at least 2 weeks before, because if we have to know if we got enough folks signed up for it, we can go for it. Otherwise, we'll have to cancel it. So.
Gotcha. Well, and hopefully, fingers crossed, too, if it gets too big, hopefully that Parsons Research and Extension Center can hold everybody.
It can handle up to 100 people.
There we go.
Yeah,
it's
I
a great
don't know
facility
if I can handle
there.
It.
Again, speaking with Jacob Weber as well as David Scrantz here on this Wednesday morning. Again, any information that you might want on this Master Gardener, I would just give your local Extension office a call. Or again, you can listen back to this interview with all of that great information there on our website, their main screen of it. Well, we had mentioned, and actually a caller, and something that I've been checking in, week out with you, was those Japanese beetles, but also some other things. Other critters, always got to check on the critters week in, week out with you, Jacob. But now webworms might be popping up.
Fall webworm, see a few nests here and there. It's not going to be too bad here for this first generation. Fall webworm, there's about two generations per year in our area. Now, what I mean by generation, we have egg laying, egg hatch, larval development. Larva is a caterpillar, and then it goes into the pupa phase, which the caterpillars disperse from the tree, and then they pupate, emerge as moths, mate, and a second generation egg laying activity begins in late July, early August, mid-August, and the second generation gets cranked up and goes into the fall. And we've had some years when we've had these webbed nests. Some people call them bags on the trees, but they're actually webbed nests. The webbing is to protect the caterpillar from the environment and from predators, which they're pretty good eats for birds and other insects as well. I've seen wasps go after a fall webworm caterpillar. But what the caterpillars do, they consume foliage. They consume the leaves only on the tree. And they have certain trees that are favorite. Persimmon is number one. If you're going to see fall webworm, you'll first notice them on persimmon trees. But they also like sweet gum, pecan, and walnut. Those are other favorite trees, but they'll be on sycamore and elm. I really don't see them on oak trees. I don't think they like the taste of oak leaves, but they can become so infestations can become so heavy that a tree can be completely covered with web nests. And at that point in time, you know, a lot of homeowners start pulling their hair out, screaming, my tree's going to die because it's just smothered with webs. Yeah, don't get too excited because the tree's just losing its foliage. If it occurs in the first generation, there could be some issues, but the trees usually leaf out, send out a new set of leaves, and then usually when we have a real heavy infestation, it's followed by nothing at all because the fall webworm is controlled naturally by egg parasites, insects that lay eggs or their eggs inside the eggs of the webworm eggs. And so eventually the webworm population crashes as the parasite population increases in intensity. And so we go through these waves of cycles that may have several years in between. But the fall webworm has been almost non-existent for several years. It's coming back, and it's going to come back in a big time. And, of course, get excited, but don't get too excited. Don't go doing desperate things like burning the webs out of the trees or cutting off large branches.
What's Jacob doing with a flamethrower in his backyard?
Yeah, I've heard of people doing that. And actually, sometimes those web nests come falling out of the tree on fire
goodness.
and have actually injured the person burning the... You're actually doing more damage to the tree by cutting or burning them out of the tree than actually what the webworms are doing. So best thing to do is if you don't like them, don't like the sights of them in the trees and really have a strong objection to it, you can have the tree commercially sprayed because it's going to require high pressure spray to do it. And you want to do that when the webs are very small. Or if it's a small tree and you got a long pole, long stick, bamboo pole or something like that, put a nail crosswise on the end, top end of it, and just stick it into the web nest, give it a few twists and pull, break that web up, shake the worms out on the ground, and that's the end of that. You can do an easy job of cleaning them up. It does give you the heebie-jeebies when those worms start falling on you, but other than that, it's not too bad. Just let them go. If you just ignore it, you're not going to fail the tree by not taking care of it. It's just one of those things that you go, I'd say it's a gee whiz. You'll put your hand in your pocket and say, gee whiz, okay. It gives a nice accent of ghostliness to the Halloween festivities when you have a tree covered with webs. Yeah.
Yeah, a little early for that, right?
Yeah.
For some people, though, it's almost a year-round celebration of it. But real quick, before we leave, you had mentioned, they're not necessarily too damaging to oak trees, but something certainly could be. Is that sudden oath death or disease, whatever it is. Is it? Have you heard anything else on that?
It's just mainly the... word went out that there was a nursery and from Oklahoma that had an unfortunate infestation or infection of sudden oak death, which is Phytophthora romorum. There's different Phytophthoras, but this particular one has caused an issue with oak trees, tan oak and other oak trees along the West Coast in Oregon, California, and Washington. And we don't want that disease to get cranked up here. There was an infection identified in rhododendrons from this particular nursery, and the nursery had shipped rhododendrons to Walmart stores in the area and also to the Home Depot store in Pittsburgh, Kansas. Now, there may be other Home Depot stores involved, but at least We know that that was, the shipment went to there. So if anyone has purchased a rhododendron from Walmart or Home Depot, those plants should be destroyed. They should be bagged up and put in the trash or landfill, and or buried or burned. But we want them, those plants destroyed, and you may go back to your place where you purchased it. There's a possibility. This is just not, I'm not speaking for the stores, but you may get a refund for your purchase. But it only applies to rhododendrons. It doesn't apply to any other plants. And the concern is that potential for rhododendrons, an infected rhododendron, to go ahead and infect other plants and potentially start to infect oak trees in the area. We don't have no idea how this particular disease organism will affect trees, but we just don't want to get it started. So that's the issue right now.
Yeah, I guess no news is good news sometimes with that, because I remember when it first came to the area, they were very adamant about getting that news release out to all of us.
Right.
It was straight from the Kansas Department of Agriculture itself. So again, just keep in mind, and if you have, like Jacob had said, made any 2019 purchase of them at those locations, just probably dispose of them. So again, that's Jacob Weber and Davin Skrantz with the K-State Research and Extension offices. Davin, Jacob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the Mighty 690 KGGF.